day. Time in the last when our love was strong was never really true. The time in the last didn't last too long, and now I know that you know.
Two on the dot here at WMFO Medford. I'm Mike, and I'm here on the mic till 11 a.m. It's Saturday again. It is the last day of August. I can't believe it. It's Labor Day weekend, so happy Labor Day weekend. And you know, these three-day weekends, they just come around, and you're like, oh, it's really exciting, but it's only really one more day, isn't it, Mark? And Les?
I thought you were talking to yourself for a minute, because...
Well, this is what people do in radio. They just get in front of this microphone, and they talk, and no one's usually here, but today, you guys are here.
Yeah, there's three of us today, which is good, you know?
Yeah, there's three of us.
There were four of us.
Two and a half. Now there are three.
There were. There were. So we got you guys back, and you guys come here a lot, and we're going to do a lot of the same kind of programming as when you guys are here. Mark, you've got a five-song set, but it's not Americana.
No, and it's not American either.
It's not either. I thought on the way over, I was going to go, is it really?
Four of the five songs are from British bands.
Yeah.
But it's not Britpop.
No, but that was a quote from you, and I took it from you, and I'm like, how come you said that? Because I didn't know if
you know why? Because I had deadlines. I was working. I was just throwing stuff out there. I had no idea.
I just take things
I could have
verbatim.
Said something like, I'm not even coming in today.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't even know it. A nice shirt, by the way.
Did you say that? Oh, thanks.
Just a shameless promotion for a band. Right? Not my band, but a band. Cast Irons. Great shirt.
Absolutely.
I wore my Cast Iron shirt last weekend. I was, we're out in the Pioneer Valley, and actually there's no one out there, so I was going to, you know, no one was like, oh, great shirt, because there's literally no one out there.
Well, yeah.
But it's a nice shirt, comfortable, great looking.
Yep. So. And you've also got some restaurant news and reviews and stuff?
Yeah, some news. I mean, it's a slow time of year. Restaurants are really quiet right now, but there's some big news out. There's a couple reviews, and getting back to what we were talking about before I rudely interrupted you.
Were we talking about something?
I think we were. So I'm not doing Americana. I'm not doing Britpop, and everyone's probably thinking, is he okay? But I'm doing something.
Nobody's asking that because
because no one cares.
No,
because
they know you're not.
Well, that too.
Yeah, that was my.
But we'll be going in the way back. Anyways, you know, we'll be hitting some. We'll talk about it later, but it'll be music from well before Britpop or Americana.
Okay, from like the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, let's say 68 or 69 to maybe 1981.
Hmm. Okay.
Cool. How's that sound?
That'll be in the 10 o'clock hour.
Okay.
And Les, just quickly, one of the folks that you've introduced me to since you've been doing this for a couple of years is Art Tatum. And I just, you know, I'm so glad you're going to focus on him today as maybe one of the finest ever.
Well, you just now gave an opinion that begs the question I'm going to ask the thousands of people listening to me today. And that question I will bring up later. It's provocative, not because I made it up, but it's something that may be of interest to you, and actually this program could be almost entertaining.
You say that all the time, and it is entertaining for the most part. Yeah, all right, so we'll look forward to that. Probably about 9:30, 9:35, we'll get back to you.
Okay.
All right, so...
Now what?
Now new noise.
Should we talk about the weather?
Well, we could.
Okay. Actually, you know what stinks about a 70-degree day?
What?
It's not interesting. So whenever we come in here, it's usually, oh, it's 100 degrees. Then we talk about that for 10 minutes. Yeah. Or, oh, it's 10 below. But when it's 70, it's kind of boring.
Normal doesn't work for us.
No, I don't like normal.
Oh, forget it.
So anyways, new noise?
New noise. I'm doing a preemptive request for Mike Maloney because I know that he'd want me to play the new Infinite Sonic track.
But of course. It's good stuff.
It's really good. It's really good stuff. It's climbing up the charts. It's getting a lot of recognition. And Infinite Sonic equals Sonic. I mean, they changed their name because they had some Google issues when trying to find the name and all that stuff. So they've regrouped and they've got a kind of a really new sound on this one.
Yeah.
I played it once before, but happy to play it again. The new noise is Infinite Sonic. This is called Retrofit. Brand new here at WMFO Medford.
I get to do it all. I'll never learn. So she said, what's the problem, baby? What's the problem? I don't know. Well, maybe I'm in love, love. Think about it every time I think about it. Can't stop.
The Massachusetts Department of Fire Services encourages you to beat the beep. Carbon monoxide alarms have been required in nearly every residence since March of 2006. Did you know that the life expectancy of these alarms are only 5 to 7 years, depending on the manufacturer? Many detectors installed after the state's carbon monoxide law was passed are now reaching the end of their useful life and need to be replaced. One sign that a carbon monoxide alarm should be replaced is a chirping sound that sounds until the unit is powered off. This chirping sound will continue even after new batteries have been installed. Models with the digital readout will show an ERR, or E09, or end message in the display. The purpose of Beat the Beep campaign is to alert residents that their carbon monoxide alarms may be reaching the end of their life cycles and should be replaced before the beeps indicate the end of the life of the detector. This public safety message brought to you by the Massachusetts Department of Fire Services, your local fire department, and your friends at WMFO.
This is more like it.
You're listening to WMFO Medford.
A 100 miles of blacktop, pedal down, won't stop. Dragging around this U-Haul. If you try to reach me, phone's in the backseat. I ain't picking up when you call. You're all sorry, baby, but sorry don't cut it. Our love is a long past fixing. I'm leaving, breathing freedom.
WMFO in Medford. It is, hi there, 9:23 in the morning. It's Mike here.
And it's Mark here.
And it's
Les here.
Like seals, well-trained.
Isn't it, though?
Here's a fish.
I was thinking the exact same thing, you know.
Probably?
I was.
I think you probably were, I know.
I don't know.
I know how it goes.
Yeah.
All right, so this is how it went in this set. I played a set of music. Brand new noise from Infinite Sonic, from Retrofit. That's really good, isn't it? It's really good. I mean,
it is. You know who it reminds me of? Big Audio Dynamite.
Yeah.
Just a little
bit. That's high praise, man.
Yeah, you know, it sounds a little like Clash, a little like Big Audio Dynamite. I like it a lot.
Yeah, they're taking a gigantic step forward. Yeah. They've always been great, but that's, you know, they changed their name, they changed their sound. But they're also very, very free-forming. I mean, they play all sorts of genres.
Right, and they're big down in South America.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Getting a little traction around here, maybe?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. So congratulations, Thomas Faye. Nice going. Biffy Clyro. Remember when you were a kid, the neighborhood you lived in, maybe a couple houses down, it was the dark blue house with the weird pink shutters?
I do remember that.
The Clyros.
Yeah.
And their kid, Biffy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he never came out of his room. He was always sitting there in their dark.
Right.
It's Biffy. It's Biffy Clyro that did that.
Where are we going with this?
He put out a record. It's called Ellipsis, and that was Howl.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha.
Okay.
Yeah. Counting Crows after that, one of Mark's favorite songs. From films about ghosts, the best of Counting Crows, Accidentally in Love. Candy Butchers, kind of local music. Absolutely, you know. From 2002's Play With Your Head, You Belong to Me Now.
Yeah. Are they
Mike
still around?
Mike Viola. Mike is.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Different band?
Yeah. Well, he does a lot of solo stuff and whatever, but he's just great stuff. And ended with, so excited, Jennifer Bell, who was my guest just a couple weeks ago from California. We were talking about the exciting stuff that's happening to her. And we had mentioned that this song, Moving Day, is just really moving up the charts. And last night, she announced online that it's number one.
So number one on the country charts, huh?
Yeah, very exciting.
Boy,
really exciting.
Great.
So
congratulations.
Really happy for her.
And she's from California, you
California,
said?
Yeah.
Okay.
Really great. Cool, Jennifer. Congrats to you.
Excellent news.
All right. So at 9:25 in the morning, going to play another quick set, and then we're going to come up with Mr. Les Hurwitz in just a few. But I have a new noise from the shirt that I'm wearing, the Cast Irons.
Oh, this is exciting stuff.
They've got some new stuff in there. Yeah. They've been spending a lot of time in the studio, a lot of vocal work. They've got well, I'll just let you hear it. This is called By the Light of the Moon, newly recorded, newly mastered by the Cast Irons. New noise here at WMFO, Medford. Oh God! You know, I started it and I didn't put the volume up. How silly of me! I don't know, why would I do that kind of thing. Any ideas?
I have a few.
Okay,
but I won't talk. I won't mention them right now.
All right, let's not.
When Glenn first recorded Galveston, he kind of did it as in a medium march. It was like, it was a little faster than I had intended it for it to be. But then I wasn't complaining either because it was top 10. As the years have gone by, the tempo seems to have settled back, you know, to where it was originally meant to be. And it's almost as though songs know where they want to be sung. They know how fast they want to be sung. And if you try to sing them any faster, they creak and they protest and they complain until finally you get them back to where they should have been maybe in the beginning.
Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea winds blowing, and I still see her dark eyes glowing. She was 21 when I left Galveston. Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea waves crashing while I watch the cannons flashing. I clean my gun, then dream of Galveston. I still see her standing by the water, standing there looking out to sea, and is she waiting there for me? Where we used to go. Galveston, oh Galveston, I am so afraid of dying before I dry the tears she's crying, before I watch your seabirds flying in the sun at Galveston, Lord, at Galveston.
WMFO. Wow, what a beautiful version of that, huh? Galveston. That was, of course, the great Glen Campbell. Not the album version, of course, which is wonderful. But that was from a show that Jimmy Webb does called In Session. And Jimmy Webb wrote that. And I just happened to find that again the other day. It's out. They've released it, and that whole series. But what a beautiful version of that song by Glen Campbell.
I know.
He always
what a voice.
Yeah.
And of course, great guitarist. And
He
is missed very much. That's
very much.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So that was Galveston. And as I clicked the mouse to see what I played, just before that was Crosby, Stills, and Nash from a 1977 CSN album. That was Dark Star. And started off the set with a faux pas from me when I started it. But we love them, the Cast Irons. A lot of new work put out, and that was, we've heard that song before, but not like that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a YouTube video on that, or maybe I was sent a video of that, but that's a different version for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the female vocalist there
she
and everything.
She adds so much to it.
Yeah, and just the vocal work that they're all doing. Congratulations, you guys.
Yeah,
that was really, really good. All right, so at 9:41 in the morning, happy to welcome back our friend Les Hurwitz. Hello, Les.
Hi, good morning, Mike.
Good morning. So you have some things to talk about one of, what do you call, is, I guess he's a composer and a performer, correct?
Who? Which one?
Art
well,
Tatum.
Yeah, he didn't compose very much, but he did. But as a performer, oh boy, that's another thing.
All right, well, let's talk all about that.
Okay.
Okay.
I'd like to deal with a question that probably will be quite provocative to many of you, and simply because perhaps you've never heard this question bandied about before, and I kind of doubt that you might hear it again unless the consciousness comes up within the context. And it's a daring question, not because I'm doing it, and because it is also unanswerable. There is no way to answer this question, but the question itself is so pregnant and so loaded with meaning. Let me ask you a question. First of all, Art Tatum has been known now for the better part of a century. He died mid-century, 20th century, and for the last 75 or 80 years, maintains his power, especially among jazz musicians. Now, of course, as a musicologist, I don't specialize in that aspect, but there is a binding reality. Let's ask this question. First of all, let's take a look at the piano, and when we hear a great classical pianist, and then how about realizing that it's the same instrument, a different brand, but the same instrument played by the jazz pianist? And the question is, in this case, why is it, one of the questions, why is it that for the past better part of a century, in music conservatories and music schools, colleges, all over the Western world, the name of Art Tatum probably is showing up somewhere in the world in terms of discussion about who he was, what he was, and how does he affect, and this sort of thing. Why is it that a jazz musician has such an effect in terms of remembrance upon institutions of music which primarily, not all, deal with classical music? Of course, there's some great jazz institutions too, but I'm talking about the fact that essentially we think of the music school, the music college, as dealing with serious music. I use the word serious as opposed to classical, and I discussed it at another time a long time ago, so we won't get into that. But we're going to be dealing with both serious and classical today, with Art Tatum as being the central figure. Now, the question I just asked you about, why is it that Tatum is brought up everywhere, from day to day? I remember when I taught at Longy, there were many times when I was stopped, either by a faculty member or a student, the question was dealing with the name Art Tatum for whatever reason, primarily, of course, because of what he did on the instrument. Another question is this. Why is it that at lunch on a particular day in, near Tanglewood, I was having lunch with the pianist who was to play that night, the Norwegian pianist Leif Ove Andsnes, with whom I had become befriended. And he had heard that I was working on something called the Tatum Project, which dealt with an examination of the parallels in playing of the instrument between classical, that is serious, and jazz. And I discussed it with Leif Ove, and the first thing that he asked in terms of any question was, would you please send me a copy of your project to me? Now, can you imagine arguably the greatest living classical pianist asking me a question about Art Tatum in that sense? Could you send the material that you put together in Art Tatum to me in Norway, whenever you can do that? So, that question, that's a pretty pregnant question, and I was honored, let's put it that way. And I will explain that to now. The question I beg is it possible, and there's no way to answer this because controversy would show up because of opinion. And that is it possible, just possible, to consider that no pianist in recorded history or even pre-recording history, like 19th century, early to middle 19th century before Edison and his cylinder, is it possible to consider that as a player of the instrument, a player of the piano, the physical, technical aspect, is it possible that no one exceeded the playing abilities, the natural abilities that were given to this man, who first of all had total blindness in one eye and perhaps 8% in the other? He was legally blind, and yet became a towering figure in playing an instrument he could barely see. Another question, how about George Shearing, the great pop pianist, who was born blind, never saw the piano in any way that you and I see every day, perhaps? And how did he learn to play the piano? And I asked George Shearing at an interview one day that question, and he smiled, and he gave me about a 20-minute answer, and we'll talk about it someday. How did you learn the distance between yourself and each and every one of the 88 notes on that instrument, being able to hit the center of each instrument? So when I think of the reality that most of us are sighted, and we see, for instance, the great pianist, jazz or classical or country or whatever, he sees the keyboard that he's playing, obviously, and is looking at the notes he's about to play and has played. But what about how did Art Tatum, quote unquote, or Jared Shearing, quote unquote, see the instrument? They saw the instrument in terms that are so pure that none of us can even begin to understand how that process is there, but somehow it is. And when we hear the likes of a Shearing or a Tatum, virtually incapable of playing a wrong note, hitting the dead center of each and every one of those notes, and not seeing the piano the way you and I do. I mean, how do you deal with, say, color in music? How did George Shearing get to know the difference between red and blue? What about the color blues in music? How does that describe to a musician who has never seen color and doesn't even understand the essence of what color is? So, you know, there are all kinds of questions that are absolutely unanswerable, and we'll never know. All we know is that there is a miracle that is given to some, in the same sense that in every generation there are geniuses, just a few, who change the course of history in whatever subject we're talking. Now, in the case of Tatum, we're going to hear today a few of some of the things he does that it just makes it impossible to understand how someone on this planet can do what he's able to do. We will start, though, so we can start measuring in terms of where Tatum is as a player of the piano. And by the way, I want to make sure that there's a distinction. When it comes to serious music, there is a world of difference between a musician, no matter what the instrument is, let's say in this case the piano, the player of an instrument, and the greatness of his playing, as opposed to the greatness in the music that comes out of his playing. There is a difference. So the vehicle upon which great music comes is that technique, that incredible physical technique. And I'm going to talk about not great music today. That is the music that puts us in a different place upon hearing it and after hearing it. You were in a different place. How do you describe the word great anyway? I can't. There is a definition, but I really don't understand. It's the same thing as asking, why don't you tell me how to tie a tie over the telephone? It's the same kind of reality. And we're not going to get into that mystery. But I want to point out today the subject of the question, was Tatum as good a player of the instrument in his music as, say, the Horowitz or the Rubinsteins or the Rachmaninoffs on the other side? You know, there is a question sometimes that just takes it for granted. We're talking about two societies. We're talking about class distinction. When we talk about serious music, do we put our nose in the air and say, hey, we're above you because you're jazz. You don't read necessarily, and you can come up with something like Louis Armstrong. That's not what I'm talking about at all. There is just as much to be said in jazz, if it's what we call great jazz or pop or whatever, as there is on the other side. It's just the vehicle and stylistic difference. But the instrument is the same. The same 88 notes on the piano, the same 12-note system, the diatonic system, in both blues and country and Beethoven. They're all the same notes, and we never run out of these notes. It's a miracle unto itself. So let's get back now. I'm going to start the program by having you hear two classical pianists. And both of them will be playing pieces by Chopin. Both will be playing an etude by Chopin. The word etude means study, of course. And Chopin wrote two sets of studies to examine the physical nature, the technology possibilities on the instrument to cast forward the possibility of the writing that follows it. So these are exercises, but at an extremely high level. The first etude or exercise deals with the right hand. And you're going to hear notes in the right hand played at the rate of about 18 per second without a break. It's from the beginning to the end, 3 minutes of what equals about 18 notes per second, and is primarily right-handed. In the second piece, you're at the same speed going to hear the etude, another etude of Chopin, played by a different person, in the left hand. He examined both hands just to make sure that the technology for both hands is dealt with. And by the way, when the etude is played correctly, especially by a great technician, and if he happens to be a great musician, that's even better, the music becomes something other than an exercise. It becomes a great piece of music. One of the reasons that we still hear these pieces 200 years after they were written. The first performance will be by a young Russian, then at that time, young, about 30 years ago, maybe 40 now, Vladimir Ashkenazy, A-S-H-K-E-N-A-Z-Y. He's still with us, and he's one of the top five or six pianists in the world. This performance was done when he was just starting out, and you're going to hear him play before a live audience, the A2 dealing with the right hand, about 18 notes per second. And then the second, I'm going to have you hear them without interruption, by the great Russian pianist Vladimir Horowitz, playing a Chopin A2 dealing with the left hand. Both pieces at approximately the same speed. What I want you to hear is simply the great athleticism coming out of the performances, and to hear the clarity and the disposition, the placement of each note absolutely in perfect place at the rate of that 18 about notes per second for 3 minutes, both pieces. Here we go. Okay, now, of course, if you have nothing better to do, why don't you multiply 18 notes per second by 2.5 to 3 minutes? And without any break, that man just played every note perfectly and in proper place and in proper context. Why not listen to the great Horowitz do the same thing, except in the etude for the left hand called the Revolutionary Etude? Now, the point of my having you hear these two pieces is based upon the reality of the question, is Art Tatum the equal of that as a piano player? And let's get into the situation. First of all, keep in mind that Tatum could not see the piano the way you and I could, but that doesn't mean could not is in the pejorative. He saw the piano better than any of us could ever see it. Obviously, that's proven in what we hear. Now, listen for the same kind of freedom that comes out of his playing. Here's another aspect, another ingredient, which in pop music occurs, which cannot occur in classical. You cannot improvise in classical. The notes must remain the same. And for that reason, we have something that Tatum can do that Horvitz cannot do, or any of the classical musicians. Listen to something called I Would Do Anything for You, and listen to the patterns that will never be repeated. If he played this thing four times thereafter, each time it would be a little different because he's improvising upon the harmonies that don't change. And listen to the freedom in the technique, and also listen to a pianist, a rare jazz pianist who uses both hands equally. Here is I Would Do Anything for You with Art Tatum.
We have a slight internet problem, so...
I'm sorry?
We have a slight problem with the internet, so it'll be a second or two, a minute or two, so... Sorry
Shall
about
keep
that.
Writing?
Yeah, because we have just a slight issue with the online right now, the internet here. Ooh. So I'm going to work on it while you're talking. So
okay. Shall I continue talking now then?
Yes, please.
Okay.
And you're listening to WMFO, Medford.
Okay. While we're waiting for this, and you can give me a signal, Mark, when you're ready, when it's all set, or Mike. The issue here is something that led to a question that... Well, a statement that Horvitz made, and it was sensationalized,